From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT with Trish Wood.
Hi, everybody. This is Trish Wood, and you are on The Fringe with me this Saturday afternoon. I'm in Toronto. It's really raining here, but I love that. It's very cozy. It reminds me of something, whether you know this or not, I'm unclear, but it's a bit obscure. But English country houses, where it always is raining, have a very small, specially purposed living room. They have the big grand halls, of course, and all the super large rooms, but many country houses have a very small living room, almost especially for rainy days like today is here, and they're called snugs. Isn't that great? It's a little tiny room with a really big fireplace and super soft down-filled cushions, and that's just exactly how I would like to be living my life. I'm not. I live in a good neighborhood, but as I say, I'm rich adjacent, sadly, just adjacent, but I'm feeling snug. And guess who's here with me today? You met her last week, inadvertently for the first time when she started barking, my little rescue girl, whose name is Chili, because Chili is from Puebla, Mexico, where she spent 4 years in a shelter. Isn't that awful? She was a little street girl, and they picked her up and kept her in this wonderful shelter. They have great shelters for dogs in Mexico because there's so many street dogs. They breed like mad. And Mexican dogs are actually very good dogs. Temperamentally, they're lovely, and they love people, as is she. But I think because she's black, people don't adopt black dogs as much as they do others. And oddly, she doesn't photograph that well. So the rescue agencies that try to have these dogs adopted out in North America, they couldn't really get a good picture of her. And I took her just because of her story and her temperament. She's about 6 now. And then when I first laid eyes on her, she was the cutest thing I'd ever seen. I met her in a park just outside of Toronto with the woman who was fostering her, and she was the cutest girl. So we both totally won that argument. It was just an amazing addition to my life. But she does sit in the studio with me, and she's as quiet as a mouse, except as you may have heard last week, there was somebody with a small dog outside the window. And when the dog started barking, I guess she started feeling like maybe her territory was being encroached on, but not today. She snuggled up and cozy and snug in my studio. The other thing I just wanted to say, as I was listening to the news coming into this 2-hour slot that I'm so grateful to have and look forward to every week getting to talk to y'all, is this is a full circle for me. I had a long career, a few decades, I won't say how many. And interestingly, my very first job was at a radio station in Vancouver that kind of operated the same way this one does. I read the local news. So my 5 minutes was a cut-in to national news that was read from the headquarters in Ottawa. So I'd go into the studio and put my headphones on and wait for the cue, and they would throw to me, and then I would read my 5 minutes of news and then sign off. And because it was called CKO, and it was not a really well-funded operation, so when I got good at doing it and not afraid to be on mic, I would go. I had the weekend shift, and I was there alone, so I would unlock the door and go in and have to turn the transmitter on and then call my grandmother and say, "Are we broadcasting?" Or it was like crazy, right? Sort of fun. One day I had to leave the studio to go for a bathroom break and locked myself out of the studio, which of course caused a massive, massive crisis for the news director who was at home for the weekend, because they would throw now to your local affiliates expecting people to read the local news. And from Vancouver, all they were getting was this kind of what we call in the business dead air, because I was locked out. So he went racing over and thought that I'd come to some harm, but I was just standing outside the studio, the locked studio, crying because I thought I was going to get fired, but I didn't get fired. So that's my story. But I do feel that way every time I'm sitting by waiting for my cue from the top of the hour here on TNT Radio. And I feel just like I did way back then, but better because I'm more confident now. Anyway, our guests today are two of my absolute favorites. I can ask them about any subject and they say way smarter things than I do. They're absolutely great. One of them is Ralph Schollenhammer, who I had on not that long ago. And I liked him so much that I said, let's have you back soon. And you know what? I actually meant it. So Ralph Schollenhammer is here for hour one, coming up really soon. And then the one, the only, the great Karen Hunt will be on in the second hour. Also a favorite of mine. Boy, can she write. Her Substack is a miracle. And I'm going to discuss with both of them this really interesting phenomena that has popped up on the cultural landscape. And that is, interestingly, what seems to be the rehabilitation of Andrew Tate by conservative media, right? And I am not one of those women who hates masculine men. I love all of Jordan Peterson's ideas. When the truckers hit the road to rescue us from mandates, even though they were led by a woman, namely Tamara Leach, who I've had on the show here for you, it was mostly men. And I said, yay, the real men are finally coming. So that's who I am. I'm not in any way threatened by masculinity. I have two boys who are 6'3" and play basketball and all that stuff. So I'm not skeptical of Andrew Tate because I bring any ideology to the question. But unless this is the most sophisticated smear campaign in the history of the world, and listen, poking holes in smear campaigns is my stock and trade. I've been doing it my whole adult life as an investigative journalist. I don't understand why Tucker Carlson and Candace Owen have given him a kind of a wide berth, right? Like I watched Tucker's interview with him, which has got millions and millions of views on Twitter, and I had a very uneasy feeling about it. I thought to myself, for the first time ever, has Tucker Carlson blown it on this one? Has he made a mistake about who this guy really is? I don't know. And you may be saying, why are we discussing this guy? Who cares? But it matters because if Candace and Tucker have got this guy wrong, that is not a small thing, because I will say to you, and I know I'm sticking my neck out here, but I trust Tucker. I do trust Tucker. And I know, having been in the business for a long time, he's got insanely good researchers working for him, just the best. The people who plug in the research for his monologues are, in my view, probably the best in the business. So it's weird that they wouldn't understand his background, that they would let him write it off as a smear campaign or bad stuff I did, but I don't do that anymore. I mean, yeah, everybody gets, you know, a free pass when they confess their sins. I'm a big believer in that. Obviously, I'm a recovering alcoholic, so I think everybody gets another turn. But that doesn't explain these two interviews for me. I'm really bugged by them. So just coincidentally, both Ralph and Karen have written a little bit about that and spoken about that. So I'm going to bring it up with both of them, you know, a male and a female, and see what they think of it. Am I wrong? Have I judged Andrew Tate incorrectly? I'll tell you something else that was interesting. I was at my gym trying to get back into my pre-COVID-19 shape, which at my age is a nightmare, let me tell you. Although I have heard the click, and I'm starting to really want to go to the gym again, which is a great gift, you know, when that happens, right? Finally, I want to go. And a lot of the young trainers who I like very much, oh, they're great guys. We were chatting about Andrew Tate, and they don't see it the way I do, and they're not fools either. They were like, oh, that was old, and he doesn't do that anymore, and we have to. So he's a very lightning rod figure, but I don't get why people I admire are treating his past with kid gloves. And I am open for any and all views on this. I won't say that I'm Andrew Tate agnostic. I'm a little bit more in the ick, you know. I mean, if in fact he did beat her with a belt and he was pimping out chicks, I mean, no, I can't, no, I just can't go with that. I can forgive him, but I'm not sure he's kind of over that, because doing those things does require a certain attitude about women. And I think no matter how middle of the road we are on some of those issues. And I'm a fact-based feminist, right? I thought Me Too was dangerous and I hate false allegations. But I can't ride with it yet. And I'm really, really curious to see what both of our guests have to say. So if that interests you, stick around. I also, before we get to our guest at in a couple of minutes, about 20 after, I want to talk to you about a story that I was researching all week. It's really important. It's made news around the world, interestingly, because it is a real repudiation of bringing in anti-racist training in organizations, which they're all doing. As you know, after George Floyd, everybody went insane. And especially corporations, the Black Lives Matter symbols went up on social media, regardless of if they were, you know, actually doing good or how many cities got burned down or whatever lies were told, right? That's just everybody got scared. And rightly so. Look, I was traumatized by watching that video myself. So, yeah, I get it. I totally get it. And I have been called up by some people, conservative people, for saying that. But listen, regardless of if George Floyd died of a drug overdose, of fentanyl, or whatever, and Derek Chauvin didn't directly cause his death, I don't care. Any guy who's kneeling on a suspect or someone he's arresting, and he's not checking his breathing, and he's not, you know, I mean, he was responsible. Chauvin, he should have been more careful. They should have been calling an ambulance. They should have been doing, you know, chest compressions and all that. And they didn't. So sorry, that's just my view of it. But anyway, so everybody was traumatized and the world went crazy and corporations wanted to inoculate themselves and lots of white people were flagellating themselves. And so what grew up are these anti-racist trainings, which make a fortune. They're quite expensive and they bring people in to, in my view, berate their employees. And they say things in what I call is a tautology. There's no way in and there's no way out of the arguments they're making. If you challenge them, you're a fragile white person who can't accept facts from a black. I mean, just, you can't win. I mean, it's just divisive and awful. And they need to stop it. I think we all need to think about racism and not be that way and care more deeply about how we behave in the world. Absolutely. But anti-racist training is not the way. It's very dangerous. So what happened here in Toronto was that a principal of august reputation named Richard Bilstow committed suicide a few weeks ago. And he was a guy who had been through some anti-racist training through the Toronto District School Board. They brought in a consultant to do it. There were two or three events he attended. And the nutshell story is that on the first day with this trainer, she said that Canada is more racist than the United States. No one says that. No sane person says that. We didn't have slavery. Canada's considered, you know, pretty much, much better in that view. But because we have a colonial past and a queen, blah, blah, hence, we must be more racist. She didn't provide any evidence for it. She referenced a Maclean's magazine piece, right? Not science, just something that buttressed her view that I think was speaking, and she even admitted it, more on Indigenous people who we were pretty crappy to, and we do have a long way to walk on that issue still, in my opinion, but not on much of the other stuff that's going on. I don't see Canada as a racist country in that way. So Richard Bilstow, who'd been a teacher in Buffalo, New York, just to hop across the border from here, in an inner city school with lots of black kids who weren't doing well, said very politely, I don't agree with you about that. And here's why. He laid out his case. I know this is true because I have a copy of a lawsuit that he had launched against the Toronto School Board. And in the lawsuit are transcripts of what was said. And the response to what he said by the trainer was, I mean, it felt almost libelous, right? It implied that his correction of her, however polite, meant that he supported white supremacy and he didn't want to fix the problem. It's just awful. And that happened again at the next one that he attended. She apparently went on even longer the next time, and he was mortified by that, because at these trainings there were like 200 of his colleagues there. So anyway, long story short, his career, and it had been a big career, was over. He spiraled down into a very, very deep depression over it, and a few weeks ago killed himself. And I will tell you this, I know how he killed himself. I'm not going to tell you because it's too awful, but listen, and I want to respect his privacy and that of his family, but it was the kind of way where there was no doubt that he wanted to end it. It was not a cry for help. So lots of things are happening around this now. The health ministry here is doing an investigation, and people are going to start looking at this. And this may be because of the publicity around it. It may be the beginning of the end of this stuff. And I hope that what they did to Richard Biltstow, they are not doing when they bring this into the classroom. But, you know, they're training teachers. And I hope the teachers are not speaking to the kids like they treat it. I hope they're not centering out white kids in class and making them feel bad and guilty and horrible. That we can't have that. This is traumatic. And I wondered out loud if the people doing the training had any psychiatric credentials. Do they have PhDs in psychology? Do they know how far they can push this? It's kind of like Scared Straight, you know, that old documentary where you scare the crap out of kids so they don't reoffend. But that's very, very dangerous. And this is kind of that in a way. Look, the trainers may be well-meaning. I couldn't disagree with them more on how they're doing it. But this is not working. It's dividing people and apparently ruining people's lives. And this was a very, very, very sad story. But it's got people talking all around the world. They are talking about Richard Biltstow and what happened here in Toronto, Canada, about that. So I'll talk a little bit more about it in the next hour. I'm just going to read you something from a document that was written about what this did to his mental health, so you fully understand it. But right now, as I said, we have Ralph Schollhammer. He's standing by. And because I always like to do a deep dive with him the minute we start talking, we're going to go to break, and then we're going to bring him in. This is Trish Wood on TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Katie Hopkins.
He said, I'm going to adjourn this. And he'd received letters from locals about the impact it would have on them, which had obviously been well written and obviously had worked on points of the law, which is brilliant. He said, I am minded to invite these local peoples to have their say in open court. And I am minded to review what's gone on with Carmarthenshire Council and their appeal against this. And I'm minded to have a bit more of a reflection on this, meaning I need some time to read this down. Thing. But also, evidently, I learn judges are not that impressed when short order stuff happens or short notice stuff, because basically they see what the person's trying to do, which is kind of trick people. But the win, because as we know here, we take a win when we get one. The police thought they'd be able to start moving people. The hotel owners thought they could run this through roughshod because the protesters wouldn't be organized. I say protesters, they're not protesting. They're making a damn stand. They're positively making a stand. They're not protesting. They're standing up for themselves. That's quite different, isn't it? Standing up for Welsh people in Wales. It's not protesting anything.
Katie Hopkins on TNT Radio. A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. TNTRadio.live.
Online.
Online.
Online streaming.
Be a part of the conversation.
I stream it all at work, and I stream it to my phone and listen to it wherever I go.
TNT.
Yes, this is TNT, and this is Trish Wood. I'm back with Ralph Schollhammer. And Ralph, I don't know if you heard my opening shtick there, but and if you're prepared actually to speak about Andrew Tate, but I know you did write something about him, and I'm just wondering if you figured out what the heck is going on. Why is he getting this positive attention from people I actually admire? And I don't get it. What do you think's going on?
Hi, Trish. Great to be on again. Yes, I was very glad that you raised this topic because I think it is an important issue in our time. Kind of the so-called culture wars are important because they dominate so much of the public sphere. I'm not entirely sure, and I'm a little bit disappointed both in Tucker and in Candace Owens. Not that they have him on. I think, you know, he has become a cultural icon for better or worse. So to engage with him, I think, is a very good thing. But I feel that they didn't do their due diligence. I mean, there's a very simple question, and that why I was very surprised by Tucker's interview that you mentioned. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, I know that Tucker has at least one daughter. So as a father of a girl, I mean, a man who openly said that he, and I'm basically paraphrasing what he said, right, that he made a girl around the age of 15 fall in love with him and then basically pressured her into doing quasi-online porn, isn't that something that a father of a girl would at least bring up and say, you know, what about that? I mean, was this a good thing or what were you thinking? And instead he kind of presented him as this sage of our age who kind of deeply understood what ails us. And I think this is it's also not true. This idea that there are no male role models except on the right, except Andrew Tate, I find quite frankly, I simply find untrue. So I'm very, very disappointed in this. I have to admit, I know that the Daily Wire is kind of very keen on free speech, and I think this is all great, but it's a little absurd. So I listened to, you know, Michael Knowles and Ben Shapiro on Friday, and they talk about, you know, the ideal man, you know, get married, finish high school, find a job, kind of live the traditional conservative values. And then 2 days later, they have on Andrew Tate, where they basically say, yeah, you know, when you're in your 20s and your early 30s, if you abuse women, if you are suspected at least, but there seems to be at least some to it, of human trafficking, if you, which it is, I mean, he does not deny it, if you groom girls to do sex work for you, oh, that's just, you know, boys will be boys, it's just a youth thing. So again, if I'm a young man and I listen to the Daily Wire, which message will be more appealing to me? So I have the hard work conservative message, and I have the do whatever you want, but you can still be a conservative kind of message. So I think we know what many potentially will pick. So again, if you talk to him and you challenge him, I'm all for it. But both these interviews, they were fawning over him. And that is, for me, not understandable from a conservative perspective. Again, challenging him, right, confronting him, I'm all for it. But basically saying he's the victim, what a poor, poor man. And the other thing is, I know most of your listeners are probably, of course, in the United States, but there is a reason why he went to Eastern Europe, right? I mean, most of the sex trafficking in Europe is taking place from Eastern to Western Europe. So the reason why he set up shop in Bucharest or in Romania, right, is not because he all of a sudden found his love for the Romanian countryside, right? It is because, of course, it was kind of appealing for his business model. And we have the videos, if you look at the girls, not all of them, but many of them are of Eastern, right, European descent. So you promise them money, you promise them wealth, and then you basically abuse them psychologically and potentially also physically. And he admitted, that's kind of my thing, like, it's on tape. It's not that there is the suspicion. He admitted it, right? He talks about, oh, you take your, and his words, not mine, you know, the bottom B, as he called it, and you have your girl convince the other girl, and then you have a threesome, and then they do the cam thing. And again, if that's the kind of the new conservative lifestyle, I mean, I'm sure there are many takers for it, but I wouldn't call it conservative anymore.
Well, it's really, I'm really struggling with it. I'm so glad that you said that, because I rarely argue with Tucker. And if I do disagree with Tucker, I can always see his point and say, well, you know, like, probably Tucker and I might not agree on guns. I don't believe in grabbing guns away from people, but I don't love them. And now that after COVID, of course, and the authoritarianism, I kind of dream of having a gun, but because I don't trust them anymore. But he and I do disagree on a few things, but his opinions are well held. You know, he can argue them, as I hope I can argue most of mine. But the thing about Andrew Tate, it just made no sense. It's the only time I ever have had a really unpleasant thought about Tucker Carlson and what he's doing. I've been mad at him sometimes for something he said glibly or whatever, but this made no sense. And I will say that as a woman, and again, I am not one of those women who runs around hating men for being masculine. That is not me. I am the mother of grown men who are both masculine, and I like that about them. That's not what I'm saying. But it is offensive to most of the free-thinking world that this guy did what he did for a living. Whether it was as bad as the cops are saying, I don't really know what to believe, which is a big statement on our crazy world right now in media as well. You never know who's lying anymore. But
no, and it's,
but
it's,
I just, I could, go ahead, please.
Yeah, it's and it's. I don't even think I agree with everything you say, right? But I think what he's doing is not even masculine. And what bothers me so much is he's basically doing to Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson what he did to those girls. I mean, again, yeah, he's great at this. I mean, I admire. Well, yeah. Again, a credit where credit is due. So in the sense, he's an evil genius, and he does it to them. I'm, you know, basically the same he did to those girls, and they don't see it. This bothers me so much, right? He does the same thing. Yeah. He says, "Ah, oh, well, I'm misunderstood, but we understand each other, and you know, we kind of yeah, stand up for these downtrodden men," and so, and they lap it up just as he told those girls. Well, you know, I think the one story he told was where he said, you know, now you work as a waitress, but if you come with me, there will be champagne and trips and all these kind of things. So he does exactly the same thing, and they don't get it. And that doesn't, to be quite, again, I love Tucker, I've been always a supporter of him, but again, I like yeah, him for what he does, and I have no issue calling out when I think he did something wrong, and he fell for it. Both of them basically fell for a very good, very creative con man. And that should not happen. As you correctly pointed out, I mean, both of them have, I would say, enough money, kind of enough of an operation to have done the due diligence necessary to prepare themselves yeah, to know, okay, this is a con man, a very good one again, and you know, an evil genius, if you want. So we have to be careful what we do. And they walked right into his trap, right? I mean, he was
yeah,
basically deliberately lying and misleading them on their shows yeah, and they couldn't call them out on it. And I find it being conned by a con man is nothing to be ashamed of, but then to kind of twist it in some form of virtue, and you know, that you were standing up again for the honest, you know, conservative men. It's not. I mean, this is simply not the case. And my basic question, this is the last thing I want to say on this issue for the Tucker Carlson thing, is would you trust your daughter with this man? But I mean, this yeah, would have, this would be, would you trust your daughter? Like, if your daughter would have been one of those girls 10 years ago, would you look back now and say, oh, well, I mean, sure, he turned my daughter into more or less prostitution 10 years ago, but that's all water under the bridge. I don't think that any father would do this. So that's why I don't understand it. If you well, really yeah, have, yeah, go yeah, on.
No, I was just going to say that the other thing that he does that doesn't seem to align with how I view, especially Tucker, is the kind of lavish spending as a defining expression of your value as a human being, right? I mean, oh yeah, he smokes cigars and flies around in a private jet. Well, yeah, what, and he has a favorite car or something, a Bugatti. Is that a Bugatti? Is that a car or a bike? I don't know. But, you know, those
are
not...
I don't know about anything about cars either.
Yeah, not my deal. But you know what? I mean, those are also not things people should aspire to. And I can tell you why not. Because I've been rich-ish and I lost it when my career blew up. And I had nothing because I was defining myself not by who I was, but what I owned. And I think encouraging young men to be successful is really, really great. And I think having money is also really great, and aspiring to have money is great. But the trappings of this kind of uber wealth, super buff, you know, private jet, cigar smoking, I mean, that's, you know, why can't kids be reading and doing what lovely spiritual things and learning how to be better and helping out at the homeless? I mean, they should do that too. Are they not going to be well-rounded people?
Well, let me give you but I think you make a great point. Let me give you an example. Somebody I think all of us on the right and conservative admire, like Thomas Sowell. Now imagine a 15, 16 year old Thomas mm-hmm. Sowell, and luckily enough, Thomas Sowell grew up in a way that for him, and also I think to his family surroundings, right, through hard work, through diligence, really a wonderful career, right? Because again, the argument, there are no role models. I think Thomas Sowell would be a perfect role model for many young men. Imagine he would have been 15 years old and would have been exposed to Andrew Tate. And said, well, wait a moment. If that's also giving me, you know, a kind of societal recognition, if this is also a kind of, let's say, a path to fame, a path to recognition, then maybe I should become a quasi pimp and not become one of the world's leading economists. So, and I think this is precisely the risk we're going at. If you, because of course, deep down, let me be completely honest with you and your listeners. Of course, deep down, most men would love to have a life where they're surrounded by cigars, fast cars, private jets, and young women who read every wish from their eyes, who do everything that they want, of course. But the whole point of masculinity, or to use another outdated term, of the gentleman, is that you don't give in to these desires. I mean, the entire base of Western civilization is that we do not do what our instincts constantly tell us. And now you have the conservatives coming along and say, oh my God, this is exactly what you should do. I do not understand what, maybe they just wanted to be provocative. All right. I think at least in your case and mine, they were successful with that.
Yeah. Well, you know, if I ever meet Tucker after I suck up to him for 15 minutes, because I think he's so great, I will say, you know, what about Andrew Tate? Let's talk about that. And knowing him, he'd probably want to hear me out. But here's the last thing I'll say about it too, is that I blame this new kind of academia managerial state nightmare that has made a mess of our world, because I wonder if the Andrew Tate obsession is because he's kind of anti-intellectual, right? He's the opposite of a learned person. And learned people, when they learn the right stuff and write poetry and paint great paintings and, like Thomas Sowell, you know, have brilliant things to say about our world and race and all the other stuff, it's really worked out. Sadly, academia has been tainted by dumb postmodernism. And so I wonder if Andrew Tate is also not representative of just kind of brute force as an antidote to insane kind of effete academia and intellectualism.
Absolutely. And you have the, I hope I get her name right. I mean, and you see, this is now becoming a business model. I'm sure you have heard of, I think her name is Hannah Pearl.
No.
If I'm not mistaken, you have to check her out. She's basically the female, and that's also what she's called. She's the female version of Andrew Tate. Like, she's basically saying the same things that he's saying, just that she's a woman. So this is now becoming a business model in many ways, right? Be over the top provocative. So you're absolutely right. Can they go look at where the left and where the postmodern academia has gone, and now go exactly into the other direction? Right, and it's in many ways it's a business model. I mean, the irony is that it's like a circle that they kind of meet each other. So that the left was all about sexuality, and now apparently the right is also becoming all about sexuality again. If this is where we want Western civilization to go, I think a conversation we probably should have. But as you said before, right? It's if the main purpose is just to be a contrarian, if the main purpose is just to have shock value, again, that's fine. Milo Yiannopoulos did this 10 years ago. So again, it's not even something particularly new. But it's also without, as you correctly pointed out, there's no analytical or, let's say, moral value to it. Okay, everybody, and I'm talking about it as well, it really upsets me. Because I like Jordan Peterson, I like Ben Shapiro, I like The Daily Wire. They have been very critical of Tate, so I don't then understand why, 2 days later, they basically offer their entire platform to him and try to rehabilitate them, which I have to say does also not shine very nicely on their credibility, because either you stand to your values or you don't. But that's something that they have, of course, to discuss with themselves. But there is no deeper meaning. Exactly what you said, there is no deeper meaning to it. Yeah. It's the veneer of a philosophy that just justifies to do whatever you want. And again, this is not really, I would say, it's neither stoic nor is it in agreement with other ancient Western or Judeo-Christian values.
No, it's just weirdness, right? It's just weirdness. Anyway, let's move on. I'm going to discuss it with Karen Hunt in the next hour, because she wrote a bit about it too. And I'd be curious also to hear the female perspective. I mean, I sort of know what Karen's going to say, because she and I, it's like you and I agree with you about just about everything. So maybe I should book people on the show that I argue with more, but I knew you'd have something smart to say. Here's what I'm going to do. We're going to do next block. I want to talk about my favorite subject with you is migration in Europe. But also, I want you to start thinking about this, and that is, how is Europe viewing the absolute and blatant corruption in Washington, D.C.? As a citizen of Canada, I want my prime minister to start making diplomatic moves saying, I don't think we want this guy, you know, being kind of the leader of the free world. We don't want to be dragged into his garbage. So we're going to take a break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about those two things. This is Trish Wood on The Fringe with Ralph Schoelhammer.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
According to the American Cancer Society, last year there were to be an estimated 1.9 million new cancer cases diagnosed, with 609,360 cancer deaths in the U.S. Joe Biden was president last year. In 2020, there were 602,350 cancer deaths, 7,005 fewer deaths than projected for 2022. Donald Trump was president in 2020. Why am I bringing this up and making it sound like a contest? Because Joe Biden has spit in the face of the millions of people who have been diagnosed with and have passed on from the dreaded disease by claiming that he, as president, well, he says he changed the cancer narrative. This is what he said on Tuesday.
I've sort of lost faith for a while on being able to do big things. If you could do anything at all, Joe, what would you do? I said I'd cure cancer. They looked at me like, why cancer? Because no one thinks we can. That's why, and we can. We end cancer as we know it. Deliver on our sacred obligation to the veterans is the second thing, I think.
I really have nothing to add here, except this is a very sick man. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought all the people that I knew who didn't drink were self-righteous people, holier than thou. So it never occurred to me that Alcoholics Anonymous was filled with people who had drank like I did, and now were the same people that I used to drink with, the same people that I liked, only now they weren't drinking. They were people just like me who had been drinking for a long time and found out that it didn't work for them anymore.
Visit AA.org for more information and download the Meeting Guide app to find a meeting near you.
Trish Wood on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, everybody. Trish Wood back with Ralph Schoelhammer. I just want to say shout out to AA. You guys know I've told you that I'm in recovery myself for, about 23 years now. And AA is the bomb. That's all I'll say about that for now, but it's really a good organization. I guess because of what we just heard in the PSAs, we should talk about maybe Biden first, because I am curious to know, in Europe, is there any buzzing about how dire the American leadership is right now? I've never seen anything like it. He is demented. He is a liar. It's clear he was involved in Hunter's business and made money from it. What more does this guy have to do before diplomats in foreign capitals are saying, you know, on the secret phones, we got to get rid of this guy? What's the buzz over there?
As a little bit of a connection to our previous conversation, I think Hunter Biden is a great example. Hunter Biden, in my opinion, that's the dumb version of Andrew Tate. This is the Andrew Tate is the evil genius, and Hunter Biden is the derelict who lived off his father's name. But behavior-wise, if you look at it, they pretty much did exactly the same thing. Just as a quick side note on this. It's absurd. I mean, I can only tell you, listeners, it's insane. In Europe, the media does not report it. They don't report it.
What?
Like everything that has, it's insane. Like everything that has been going on now with the plea deal, right? And the Department of Justice and Hunter Biden's lawyers, right? That they now walked away again from what they thought is a deal that basically, would have ensured that he cannot be prosecuted for anything else. Silence. The fact that there's, I would argue by now, is pretty good evidence that Joe Biden definitely knew that his son was doing business and that he was involved. I mean, if you have
absolutely,
my father is here with me. I mean, that's pretty clear, right? And if you look at the timelines, and he was jetting around with him on Air Force Two. So this, the same in the White House. Hunter Biden is a private citizen. No. If you do business deals on Air Force Two, you're not a private citizen. I think that's number one. But the media is closing ranks. They try to protect Joe Biden and his family at all costs. I mean, the level of the only thing that strikes me as more corrupt than currently what's going on in the White House and Joe Biden is the media.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. There's nothing, or Republicans pounce, right? Republicans won't let this go. Why? Republicans keep digging. Yes, of course, as they should, because this is information that we have is very disturbing, independently of whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. I mean, this is a lot of this is very, very serious stuff. And I'm befuddled, again, both in the American media, which seems not particularly critical, even more defensive, but the European media, again, they don't report it. With the exception, right, of the Daily Mail, there's a couple of British media outlets.
Yes.
But it's ironic, in the German-speaking world, for example, right, every typo of Donald Trump's tweets was kind of run up and down as a headline. But with Joe Biden, it's like, no, what are you talking about? Everything's fine. Nothing going on. And nothing to see here. So it's very frustrating.
This guy is a national security threat. There's no question, or an international security threat. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And, you know, I've been just mentioning Tucker Carlson. He was the first guy to interview Tony Bobulinski, you'll recall. And Tony Bobulinski, he said, I was sitting there with the big guy who was doing business with Hunter through China. I mean, why else would all of these countries be paying a coked out nincompoop with no skills, except for his access to Daddy-O and Daddy-O's power that he could exploit and sell? I mean, it is incredible that they are protecting this guy, and you're quite right to blame the media. I'm in the same boat, except that I can watch a bit of Fox News, which I like less and less these days. And I also now have started watching GB News a fair bit. I can pick it up on YouTube. And so I kind of move around. But Canada has no conservative news outlets really at all. We've got these boutique operate. We've got Rebel News, which is sometimes okay, but they bug me too. I do support them, I suppose. And True North are pretty good. But we don't really have a conservative news. So listen, if there's any billionaires listening who want to give me a big check, let's do a GB News for Canada, because we don't have that. Mm-hmm. I am watching a British news station in order to find stuff out, right? Because they won't, and Fox News, because they won't cover it here. It's ridiculous. And I, you know, for me, I mean, is it just that the globalists want Biden? It's just that he's the WEF candidate du jour. I also hear from people, Obama's really the power behind that throne and everything. It's so Byzantine. And I'll tell you something else. I am sick of it. I don't know how much longer those of us who are awake and seeing these problems play out of absolute and dire corruption, you know, it's hard on us, right? I'm exhausted with it and not seeing really too much changing about it. Is that how you feel?
Yes. I mean, yes and no. I think we simply have underestimated, or many of us, at least, definitely me, I think we have completely underestimated how ideologically the ideological fervor on particularly the left side of the media. I don't think, again, I for some of them it's definitely, but I don't think it's that there's an agenda. I think they look at this guy and say, this is the guy of our team, and we have to protect him at all costs. We have, no matter what. It's just as you remember, the Washington Post, when Donald Trump became president and they had this line, the democracy dies in darkness, or when the New York Times said, well, now we can no longer report objectively because this is such a crisis of the republic. And I think it's really this. It's a team sport. The problem is, and this is something, of course, that we conservatives have only ourselves to blame. We thought that the political discourse or political decisions are made during elections, right? So you run candidates, you run political parties, and we basically ignored everything else. We ignored the cultural institutions, we ignored the media, we ignored we ignored academia, and we basically allowed the left to take all of these institutions over. And of course, now they're socializing precisely these kind of people, right, that see themselves as activists, that see themselves as ideologues, that see themselves as not reporting about the world, but having to actively change it, or whatever you want to call it. And this is the uphill battle we have to fight. And this is, as you just said, I mean, the internet, to be quite honest, the internet in a sense came to our rescue in the kind of last minute, because all of a sudden, a little bit talk radio, if you think about Rush Limbaugh, but it was like in the last minute that all of a sudden one new outlet emerged where some conservative voices could get together and start their own programs. But imagine a world without the internet. You basically would have no variety in the media. I mean, it would all be the same. And I would not be said, we probably as similar as it was with John F. Kennedy, right? We only years after his assassination, let's say the darker sides of his lifestyle came to light, it would probably be the same thing here. We probably would not know about it. And I see it here in Europe. There is basically, with few exceptions, but for the vast population, there is a complete blackout about what's currently going on with the American president, because nobody reports it.
And as I said, just in asking you that question, it's no small thing. It's not about politics. When somebody is that corrupt and that completely mentally out of it at a time when there is a major war underway that may at some point involve nuclear weapons, this is just absolutely morally completely reprehensible that the media are supporting this guy. It just makes me so angry, especially as a former legacy media journalist, right? Like I don't know what Kool-Aid they've been drinking. I don't know what's happened to these people that they think it's okay to defend the absolutely indefensible. I mean, it's just mind-blowing.
Yeah.
But I don't want to stay on that, because I want to get you on my the migrant story, which is really on one hand exploding and on the other hand more of the same, right? It feels like, and we just heard Katie Hopkins' commentary coming in about Wales, but it just feels like there's no way for real people to stop the nonsense. The politicians do not care what we think. And even now in Toronto, Canada, we had a little migrant camp set up downtown, and our new mayor, far left mayor, Olivia Chow, wants people to open up empty apartments to give them places to live. And I'm thinking, like, we have a ton of people in this city who cannot afford apartments. Most kids graduating high school cannot, or not high school, but uni, can't afford an apartment in this town. Like, when do people start putting the citizenry first and saying, no, not until we're sorted out? It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, Ralph. And I just find the whole thing very disheartening. What's going on?
No, it is. And it's we talked about this a little bit last time. And I would say that Western civilization, if we want to use this broad term, is afflicted with a kind of autoimmune disease. What I mean by this is we constantly have this guilt complex. There's a French philosopher, Pascal Bruckner, almost a decade ago, wrote this great book that's titled The Tyranny of Guilt, where it pretty much describes exactly this. It's a constant attempt to atone for the sins of the past, for whatever they might be, through the treatment of immigrants, through the matter of migration, through the matter of how to treat refugees. In a sense, and this I think is again the frustrating part of this, it really isn't about the migrants. It really isn't about the refugees, right? They are just a tool, if you want, to make a specific class of people feel better. So it's also, by the way, unfair to the migrants, which is why, for example, actual policies that would lead to integration and assimilation are never really pursued, right? You bring them in, then you throw some money at the problem, and then you can say, look what I did. Look at the United States, right? You basically have no southern border anymore to speak of. These people pour into the country and nobody takes care of them. But politicians go and sound off on how humanitarian they are, and how San Francisco is a sanctuary city, and how New York is a sanctuary city. And I mean, we all remember. And then if Ron DeSantis or the governor of Texas puts 25 migrants into a bus and lets them travel up to Martha's Vineyard, all of Martha's Vineyard is up in arms about, you know, what we have a humanitarian crisis. There are 25 refugees, right? And in Texas, they have thousands upon thousands, and that's what it is. But it's the people in New York and California who say, how can you be for a wall, and how can you be for stronger immigration laws? It's what Rob Henderson, for those of you interested in this, calls so-called luxury beliefs. It's a luxury belief in the sense that an elite class believes in it. It's their luxury, and the consequences have to be borne out by somebody else. And it's exactly the same in Europe, by the way, right? At one day, we will find out whether these insane policies were traveling from Europe to the US or from the US to Europe, but it's the same in both places, with the exception of Eastern Europe, right? And this is why it may be also important for your listeners, right? This is why Poland and Hungary, and now also increasingly Italy, where they're getting such a bad press, because they no longer want to go along with this kind of quasi-religious approach to migration. They say this has to be treated as a political, as an economic issue, but it is not something to, you know, save our soul from condemnation. It's not a moral issue. It's supposed to be an economic, political, and social issue.
Well, it's quite interesting, because I think I read something that you wrote about how Olaf Scholz in Germany, he's saying that Germany needs more immigrants. And meanwhile, the Populist Party is rising in popularity. So can they not figure out that we don't want this? Like, why is he not getting
insane.
That message?
No, they're like in Germany, they were talking about 1.5 million per year. I mean, they have lost their minds. But then again, you have the absurd media, right? There's, for example, exactly as you point out, so the right-wing party, the so-called Alternative for Germany, they basically say nobody wants that, but we're the only ones who say that. And then you have, again, journalists who say, yeah, but you only complain, you have no solutions. And they, in my view, correctly say, no, we do have a solution. Our first step is not to pursue insane and suicidal policies. That's kind of the first step. And they're absolutely right. So there's, you have no pollution to the migration problem. Oh, well, actually, they do. The first step is you stop it at least for a while. I mean, at 1.5 million per year, I mean, this is utter madness.
And a profound change for German culture, too, I'm assuming, right? Like, that's what everybody's afraid of. The other thing I've noticed as with the... Go ahead.
No, just a profound change. And again, it's I'm sorry if I have to use this strong language, but they lie to us, because they say those will be 1.5 million who will then fill all these jobs for which we need skilled labor. But if we look at the last 10 years, migration was not dominated by skilled labor. It was, you know, there was the occasional Harvard graduate among them, but 99% was unskilled labor from countries with different cultures, different languages, different ways of life, that ultimately were not an addition to the German economy, but it was a drag on the German economy. But you're not allowed to say that, right? The only party who says that is then immediately called, oh, look, that's the Nazi party. I mean, it's very frustrating to live in a society where the supposed Nazi party are apparently the only ones who see reality for what it is. And of course, this then raises the question that maybe the whole Nazi and fascist is just a smear, right? Because they cannot say that they lie, because what they say is obviously true. So you say, well, what you say is true, but you are Nazis. And being a Nazi is, of course, worse than saying the truth. This is really, I think, kind of how the conversation is currently working out in most of Europe.
Well, here too. I mean, populism equals Nazi. And, you know, I think that there was a big mistake made that wasn't pushed back on earlier, right? But that they seem to get away with it. And they certainly get away with it here. And in Canada is a country that is very definitely and determinately killing itself. I mean, I feel like it's dying. And I feel on some days like our identity is dying too. I mean, this is a vast, vast country, and we have plenty of room for people who need to come here. But opening the gates and just saying, come on in, with very, very little vetting or conversations about what are they going to add to the country. I mean, of course, we have to take people in who come from places where their life is in danger. But there are places in the world where the whole country feels that way. We can't do that. So my question about migrants is always, what's the number then? If we're going to do this, then tell me what is an appropriate number, and we will have a public debate about it. And they never do that, right? They never give a number, do they?
Exactly. Or if you ask, which we tried also here in Europe, right, to say, okay, kind of what's the maximum number, right? What would be the limit? And you never get an answer. But I think the reason for this is to give you kind of two quick quotes. I'm sure that your American listeners will recall Hillary Clinton's favorite saying, that half of the country are deplorables who are beyond redemption. Yeah. And I'm sure that many of the listeners also will recall Justin Trudeau when people were protesting against the COVID measurements, the lockdowns, that everybody who protests against this is a misogynist, a racist, and probably a Nazi. This is what they think of their people. I mean this quite honestly. We have reached a point, and it's true in Europe, it's particularly true in Brussels in the European Union. They look at the majority of the people and they despise them. It's I know this is a strong word, but if you listen, and I have been at enough party meetings also of parties in Austria, if you listen how they talk, they think that most people are either idiots or rubes, and that they basically should have no say in politics after all, and they know better. And this is exactly what's going on in Canada, it's going on in the United States, it's going on in Europe, and this is why these populist parties win, because they have many crazies among them, but at least they still connect to the average person.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that they loathe us. And the interesting thing, which we can talk about next time, is the fact that they never have things on the ballot that we care about. The political parties and the media just make up stuff that we don't care about. But anyway, that's the music, which means we've got to say goodbye. Thank you so much, Ralph. It's always a pleasure. And I'm always grateful when you can. Thank you so much from Vienna. Bye, Ralph. Talk to you soon.
Goodbye. Bye.
This is Trish.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. This is Trish Wood, TNT Radio, back in a minute after the news.